This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The greatest United States senator of our time is the way President Obama remembered Ted Kennedy today. Kennedy's death last night at the age of 77 from brain cancer marks the end of an era, the end of his generation of Kennedy political leaders. Ted Kennedy represented Massachusetts in the Senate for more than 46 years. He was elected to his brother John Kennedy's seat in 1962 when he was barely old enough to hold the office. He was a staunch advocate of liberal causes and described health care reform as the cause of his life. He was also an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq, saying that the best vote he ever cast in the Senate was against going to war. We're going to listen back to the interview Senator Kennedy recorded with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in 2006, after the publication of Kennedy's book outlining his policy priorities called America Back on Track.
Senator Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book deals with a whole lot of areas, from health care to tax policy to labor relations. And I think, you know, if your book were the platform of a political candidate, and your opponent would probably go through here and add up the cost of all of the additional initiatives, and there are many, increasing unemployment compensation, increasing spending on early childhood education, college funding, federal job training. Someone would look at this and say this is an unrealistic, classic liberal tax and spend, throw money at the problem approach to government. Can America afford it?
Well, let's take some of these issues. When we put into place the Cold War GI Bill to pay for the education of all the veterans that returned from World War II, the Treasury's analysis of that showed that the Treasury received $7 for every dollar it invested in education, because these individuals had a considerable success in terms of their life career. Sil Conti, who was a Republican congressman from Massachusetts, and Tip O'Neill were the great advocates of that program. And, of course, it paid for itself many, many, many times over. Take, for example, health care. For every dollar that we are spending in health care now, 33 cents of that is non-clinical. That's administrative costs that are paying it now. No business could survive that. We are supporting the information technology. Information technology, the IT, bringing electronics into the paying of bills and the administrative costs. The Institutes of Medicine, the Academy of Sciences, said if you brought in information technology into the current healthcare system, you'd save between $150 and $175 billion a year. Do you hear me? $150 to $175 billion a year, more than enough to afford to have a national health insurance policy. Secondly, we do very poorly in the area of preventive health care. One out of every $4 that we spend in Medicare is on diabetes. One out of every $10 we spend on health care is on diabetes. There is a great deal that can be done in terms of the prevention in terms of diabetes that we don't do that can save billions and billions of dollars. You know, the fact is, if we do this in the right way, if we take into consideration prevention, if we bring into the right technologies, if we deal with the health care in the comprehensive way, we can bring the health care. If we have more competition in terms of the prescription drugs, we can bring the health care costs down, and we can pass a program. We are spending everything that needs to be spent in health care. It's just being spent in the wrong way.
Few people have had the same job for 43 years. You won election to the United States Senate in 1962. Not long after Lyndon Johnson was majority leader. I mean, you have a long tenure in this body. How has it changed?
Well, it's the most dramatic shift and change has been the force of and the presence of money and the need and necessity for candidates to go out and raise a lot of money and therefore draw them away from doing what they should be doing, and that is attending to the United States Senate. When I first arrived there, that was a 12-month job. We got used to get the 4th of July and Labor Day, And we got Christmas. I was in the mid 1960s. We were in between Christmas and New Year's voting. At that time, it was voting on the war in Vietnam. We used to get back, leave late Friday afternoon, and get back Sunday nights and be ready to go. Now, candidates and the Senate, for all intents and purposes, doesn't get going till Tuesday noon, and most of the senators are gone Thursday night. Back to raise resources for their campaigns, and it's we are I think a lesser institution, and failing to really deal with the what we should be dealing with, and that's the people's business. I think there's a way of dealing with it. I'm a strong believer in public financing of campaigns. In 1973, I had legislation with Hugh Scott, who was the Republican leader. To provide public financing of House and Senate and presidential campaigns. And we actually won it in the Senate, but we couldn't get the House of Representatives to go along with it. They've done some in the presidential campaigns, but it's in disfavor today. But that seems to me to be the way that we eventually have to go, because it's we are failing in our responsibilities, I think, to the American people institutionally.
Well, I guess we should briefly address this issue of campaign finance reform, because, you know, there was the reforms of the 70s and then more recently the McCain-Feingold measure, which, you know, it seems has really failed to keep big soft money out of elections. Why is that, and where do we go from here?
Well, as I say, I believe that what you what is necessary, what is called for, is the public financing of elections. You know, the best estimate now is that the lobbyists spend about $10 billion a year to influence legislation, about $10 billion a year. That is vastly more than what would be necessary if you had the public financing of House elections, Senate elections, and presidential elections. The principal reason that people don't want, you could do it for example, I think, believe that when the legislation that I introduced in the 1970s, which was after the Watergate, I think was 8 or 10 cents a primary voter, 12 cents in terms of a general election voter. I mean, in Massachusetts, it's somewhere around $4 or $5 million to run in a state. And that's really probably probably plenty. I mean, that gives you 4 or 5 weeks of television and enough to have a pretty good ground organization. Doesn't give you, you know, 15 or 24 weeks of television, but it gives you enough so that you're able to get across. Now, what happens is members of the Senate say, why in the world do I want to fund an opposition, and members of Congress, every 2 years? And they're going to get a chunk of change to run against me every 2 years. Why in the world do I want that? And why does a senator want to have a decently funded opponent every 6 years to run against me? Why do I want to have that? And somebody who was president would have a well-funded candidate that would run against him in 4 years. So they would rather not have that kind of – most of them would rather have the existing system where they have to go on out, because they can raise a good deal more as incumbents than the challenger. The question is, what serves the country best? And the country would better be served by having well-funded challengers that would challenge members of the House and members of the Senate and the president. That would serve them best. And it would also save them the billions of dollars that would have as a result of the lobbying, and it would save the billions, I think, of dollars in terms of the kind of tax loopholes that get written in by the lobbyists into the tax bills every year that are special interests, which these lobbyists work on. Now, those are the realities. But at this present time, people say, look, I don't want my tax money used into politics. They just don't want it. But at the end of the day, they're getting it because they're paying for it with these lobbying activities, and it's something that, as I have said, too often we're getting the best Congress that money can buy, and I think it's a real disgrace.
You know, Senator, those who know the Senate well know that you've really immersed yourself in the details, the nitty-gritty of legislation, and really learned to master the procedures and personal relationships of the Senate, and have a long list of accomplishments, not just bills passed, but also conservative initiatives thwarted, I mean, including the Republican Contract for America in the mid-90s when the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your education in the ways of the Senate. I mean, was there a time in your career when you felt you understood how this place works? Was there a mentor that helped you get there?
Well, I think the model and the standard really was is set by President Kennedy and Leverett Saltonstall. They didn't team up very often. My brother was elected to the Senate in '52. Senator Saltonstall was in there, but I noticed that they teamed up on a number of different issues. A lot of them related to particular regional issues, but I noticed that my brother and Senator Saltonstall developed a New England group of Republicans and Democrats to try and find ways of working together. I sort of grew up in that tradition about trying to get things done. I always thought that that is one of the principal reasons you're in the United States Senate, is to get things done. And that's the way I've tried to work in the United States Senate, and we have had some success. I mean, we're continuing to work now with Senator McCain on the issues of immigration and immigration reform. Right after that, we're going to work with Senator Specter on the voting rights extension, which is so important, has to be reauthorized again. We've worked with a number of different senators over the period of time. I worked with Orrin Hatch on the Ryan White legislation that had dealt with AIDS, about the CHIP program that was the Children's Health Insurance Program. He was interested in children and children's issues. So we've tried to do that, and we've had some success.
I was struck by your relationships with Orrin Hatch and Alan Simpson, who were, you know, ideologically almost polar opposites of yours, maybe. But and one of the things that's interesting to me about that is that in modern Washington, it seems to me that whenever you have a conversation with someone, there's always a subtext, and you must always be thinking, well, what's really their agenda? What are they trying to manipulate me into, or how are they trying to game me? And I wonder if it's hard to develop relationships of trust in modern Washington. It seems that you have with some of these senators.
Well, we joke both with Senator Simpson and Orrin Hatch. We used to say if we sponsored each other's legislation, usually one of us hasn't read it. You know, that was. But you know, I'd find, for example, I'd be fighting with Orrin Hatch on the floor of the Senate on fetal transplantation. There was an issue with regards to basic research and NIH funding, and I'd be fighting with him in the morning, and then I'd be going down in the afternoon working with him on the Religious Restoration Act, which we eventually got passed, about state and federal impediments on terms of religious practices. For example, the state may have a rule that no children can have wine or drink wine under 16, and yet is part of the Catholic tradition in its mass, permits them to take the wine. Well, you know, there are a number of actions that similar to this in the different religions, and Orrin and I hooked up on a way to try and to protect religious rights and protect religious liberty. So, you know, even though you differ on one time, you try and find ways of working at another. And I think unless you have that kind of a temperament, if you're going to just get upset with somebody that's just going to oppose you, you're in the wrong business, because you've got to get into another business. But you have to look at this and try and figure, well, I'll try and get that person on another bill at another time.
We're listening back to the interview Senator Ted Kennedy recorded in 2006 with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. We'll hear more of the late senator's interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Senator Ted Kennedy by listening back to the interview he recorded in 2006 with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
You know, Senator, growing up as a Kennedy, you were, of course, part of one of America's most prominent political families. And you write in your book about how you learned from your family values of public service. I mean, you know, your brother Joe having served and died in World War II. And I wonder, at what age did you become aware that as a Kennedy, great things might be expected of you?
Well, I was enormously lucky as a young person. I mean, I had a terrific grandparents that were forces in my life that spoke to me about bigotry and discrimination against the Irish and about the whole immigrant past. Parents, mother and father that were inspirational in terms of my spiritual upbringing. Had a very strong faith, and which has been very important to me, and also a love of history and an interest in political life and books and learning and people. And then I had brothers who really taught me about the importance of service. I mean, I had – and then I was very lucky because I saw the system work. I mean, I saw politics work. I saw the person go out and get elected to Congress. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean – the idea that you had a brother that was a congressman was just, I thought, was the biggest deal that could possibly ever happen to any family. And then
You were 14 when Jack was elected to Congress,
when
right?
he was yeah, elected. Right. And then, my God, he beats Cabot Lodge in 1952, and this is just unheard of. And Cabot Lodge was a big deal, and Republican this, and my brother – had done, ran a good campaign. And then in the 60 campaign, to see that move and go. So I had seen, and I still believe in the political institutions functioning and working because I've seen it done. And I believe in this whole process because I've seen it work.
You know, Senator, as I hear you describe, you know, seeing your brother go to Congress when you were at 14, I mean, when I was 14, when most people are at 14, they're utterly absorbed in themselves and their friends and their, you know, their ball games or whatever is going on at school. And here you are, you know, in a climate where, as you said, people are really part of a much wider world. Did it make you a more serious kid? Did it make you think, I need to think about how I'm going to be involved in that? Did you feel pressure?
Not really. It was really the power of example. I mean, I remember my brother when he first got elected to Congress, bringing me down to Washington and taking me by myself around to the buildings, bringing me into the House floor, bringing me over to show me the Senate, and then the Supreme Court, Library of Congress. I could always remember when I'd come down from high school, I'd go down and visit him. And, you know, I'd come in for breakfast and I'd hear them talking about interesting things. No one was saying, well, you ought to do this or ought to do that. It just seemed that the things that they were involved in, my brothers, I must say my sisters as well, Eunice with the Special Olympics, 144 different countries, my sister Jean, the very special arts programs, those that have some physical disabilities are still able to create and do incredible kinds of things. My sister Pat is very involved in a lot of the literature programs in New York City. They all were very much involved, and they were all doing interesting and involved undertakings that were involving people and events and politics. Certainly became my interest, and running for office, I was sort of thinking about that back in college. It sort of had an appeal to me, and I took it from there.
I know that besides being a father to your own children, you've had a very special, important role in the lives of the children of your brothers, President Kennedy and your brother, Senator Robert Kennedy, after their deaths. And I mean, that's been described by some as that of a surrogate father. Clearly, you've been very involved in all those kids' lives while maintaining an incredibly active and professional public life of your own. And I'm wondering, this seems to have been an enormously full, I suppose, joy and burden to carry for a long time while you were balancing this public life. And I'm just wondering if there are any insights or perspective you could share about how you have managed those competing priorities over these years.
Well, this... was sort of something sort of obviously unexpected thrust on my sisters and myself, the really extraordinary, wonderful opportunity to try and make a difference in people's lives that were missing their fathers. And it's, I think, as people find out, the time and the effort and the energy that one puts in is repaid 1,000 times, and and what you get back. And they're in a wide variety of different kinds of undertakings. I mean, whether it's documentaries or environmental movements or a wide range of different Save the Children, a great many of different types of activities. But I'm enormously proud of all of them and the things that they're doing and the involvement that they're in.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, Senator Kennedy.
Fine. Listen, I appreciate it very much. It's good to talk with you. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Senator Ted Kennedy speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in 2006. Kennedy died last night after a year-long struggle with brain cancer. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The TV series Arrested Development gave viewers and the movie industry a new appreciation of the series' star, Jason Bateman. Since the series ended in 2006, Bateman has had major roles in Hancock, Juno, and State of Play. He stars in the comedy Extract, which opens Labor Day weekend. Yesterday, we heard from the director, Mike Judge. Bateman plays the owner of a small factory making flavor extracts. His employees are eccentric losers, and he's trying to sell the factory. He has to stay so late at work, by the time he gets home, his wife is too tired to make love. He wants to have an affair, but doesn't want to hurt his wife. So his friend, a bartender played by Ben Affleck, who describes himself as an entrepreneur, spiritualist, and healer, makes this brilliant suggestion. Bateman should hire a gigolo to clean the pool and seduce his wife. Then she won't have the moral high ground when Bateman has an affair. After Affleck gives Bateman a Xanax that turns out to be a horse tranquilizer, Bateman agrees to the crazy plan. The young, attractive, and brainless gigolo is supposed to show up once at Bateman's home. Bateman is shocked to see he made a second appearance. In this scene, he calls the gigolo to find out why.
Hello. Yeah, is this Brad?
Yeah.
What were you doing at my house today?
Oh, nothing.
Bull.
Look, don't worry about it, dude. I'm gonna charge you for this one.
You had sex with my wife again?
Well, I figured we already did it once, so what's the big deal, right? Besides, I'm not going to charge you.
You are going to charge me, and I am going to pay you because you are not going to have sex with my wife for free, all right? Now listen, if I ever catch you anywhere near my house ever again, it's not going to be great, all right?
No, that's a threat. Jason Bateman, welcome to Fresh Air. You play beleaguered very well. In this movie, everyone around you is a little crazy, and you're constantly beleaguered, and you're going a little crazy yourself. Do you like doing beleaguered?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's nothing really funny about somebody who can handle everything. So I try to find some of the flaws and holes and cracks and vulnerabilities in characters. I mean, usually the characters that are funniest to me are those that think they've got a lot more on the ball than they actually do. So this guy, I didn't have to search too far to find his flaws.
Did you get any interesting direction from Mike Judge, who has worked with actors but also has done a lot of animated work and is really familiar with voice work because of the actors that do the characters for his animations?
My experience with Mike was completely effortless. He's not a micromanager at all. He's got a very specific eye, and I think that he sort of he really stays out of people's way and encourages them to do what he's hired them to do.
I want to talk about a film that you made before Extract, and it's State of Play, which is based on a BBC television series, like a miniseries. And in this movie, Ben Affleck plays a congressman whose mistress is murdered. Russell Crowe is the investigative journalist who finds that the murderer is connected to political and corporate foul play. And you're a publicist that may be implicated too. And in this scene, the journalist Russell Crowe has taken you to a motel room where he's interviewing you, more like interrogating you, and he's secretly videotaping it. You're refusing to give up any information.
Compensate me, okay?
Okay, so you want to be paid to help solve Sonia's murder.
Save it, all right? I'm in PR. I know a little bit about phrasing questions, so why don't you try phrasing it like this? Would I like to be paid for helping you get a book deal?
Nobody's here for a book deal.
Really? Everybody wants a book deal, and I'd like my cut, okay? That's just fair.
When did you meet Sonia?
Compensation.
We came here to talk, Dominic.
And you know, Bowes, I'm the talent, and I don't like the vibe, so why don't you change that up, okay?
It's a non-smoking room.
Under your name.
Okay, and then later in the scene, in this part of the interrogation, you're trying to be the one in control. But a little further down the line, you have lost control. Russell Crowe has broken you, and you're starting to confess everything that's happened.
And so I get a call. I got to go down to a street corner. I got to buy a magazine. I got to meet some new guy. This guy, you know, he's some hardcore, thick-neck, corn-fed, Navy SEAL-looking guy, you know? And he's all up in my face, scaring the hell out of me because he's pissed off and...
When was this?
This is like a month ago, you know? He's pissed off because Sonya's not giving him anything anymore.
What did he want you to do about it?
He wants me to fix it. He wants me to fix it like one of my hair dryers.
Did you?
I tried. I called. She wouldn't take my call. I go over there. I try to talk to her. She's crying.
Why is she crying? She's scared. Somebody's after her.
No, she's crying because of Collins. She was in love with him. And she was pregnant. And she didn't tell him. She didn't tell him, and, you know, she's petrified that he's going to find out what she did, and then he's not going to want her, and he's not going to want the baby, and she got so wrecked about it that she burned thousands of dollars for the paychecks. Who does that? I try to get her to just relax and think about the publicity or think about an abortion or think about, you know, word. Just keep your word. What about how your decisions are going to affect me? And then she's dead. You know, I hear it's a murder, and so I don't want anything more to do with this thing, you know? I'm just terrified, and I want to go someplace warm, and I want to come back to a clean slate, and you guys write your article and just get them off me. I'm nothing. I'm nothing to those guys.
Oh, you are so broken by the end of that scene. I just love watching that move in that movie, how you went from, like, the arrogant, sleazy publicist to somebody who's just really, like, lost and broken. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that and the, like, you know, emotional change you had to put yourself through?
It was a really great part to play, and, you know, he was a fetish club promoter. He was bisexual. He was an OxyContin addict. It was, you know, it was everything that you would want in a character. You know, it certainly wasn't boring. So I was lucky that they went with me for that, because I'm certainly not known for stuff like that, at least not in my public life. The weekends are another story, but the you know, getting to sort of that, I guess, that emotional place at the end was a result of the script, the story, and also the fact that, you know, he's popping pills throughout that sequence, and he's drinking, and so I don't know, I was really, really, really happy with it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Bateman, and he's starring in the new movie Extract, a comedy which opens Labor Day weekend. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll be back and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Bateman, and he's starring in the new comedy Extract. It opens Labor Day weekend. What are your very first memories of being directed?
The story that pops into my head is I was Little House on the Prairie was one of my first sort of big gigs, and when I was 10 or 11, I was on that for a year, and one of the first few episodes that I had to do, I got shot. I walked in on a bank being robbed, And I remember reading that in the script and thinking, wow, I get to get shot by a gun and fall to the ground. And so that day came around to shoot that scene, no pun intended. And Michael Landon was directing that episode, as he did often. And so he yells action, and I run into the bank, and the gun goes off, bang, bang. And I threw my body against the wall so hard and slid down the wall and sort of, you know, shook a little bit on the ground as the last bits of life came out of my body. And I just thought that, oh, my gosh, as my eyes were closed and just trying to stay still and not look like I was still breathing, I thought to myself, man, did you nail that? Boy, did you do a good job. And then I just remember, just hearing silence and then just a real quiet sort of from Michael Landon. Okay, let's go ahead and cut the cameras. And then I opened up one eye and watched him sort of walk over to me, and he said, go ahead and sit up. And I sat up, and he took my hand in his hands. He goes, okay, we're going to start over, and I'm just going to need you to just fall out of frame, okay, on the next take. You're going to hear a couple of bangs, and then I just need you to just drop to your knees. And the camera doesn't see you when you hit the ground anymore. So it was a little humiliating, to say the least, but it was a good first, very gentle sort of, not chastising, but, you know, sometimes it's best not to do too much acting, you know.
Also early in Little House on the Prairie, you had to watch your parents get killed as their stagecoach overturns and rolls down a hill, leaving you orphaned.
You sound like a fan. You've seen that episode.
did you remember shooting that and what the director told you about how to cry? Was that the first time that you had to, like, cry on demand?
Actually... to get that part, when I auditioned for that part, I had to cry. There's really a theme in this interview. I had to cry when I auditioned for Michael Landon, and I just remember being really proud of myself that I was able to do that. I think it was the first time I had ever sort of asked myself to cry for no reason, and it's not an easy thing to do. It's become more difficult as I've gotten older. But it was difficult back then when I was 10 or 11. So in that scene, when the parents go over the side of the cliff in a stagecoach, my sister and I, played by Missy Francis, we sort of have to take a few steps towards camera, and we're looking past camera and above camera, and we're supposed to be watching the stagecoach tumble down a 300-foot cliff with our parents inside of it and screaming and yelling and making up our own lines, you know. I mean, what do you say? No, Mom, Dad, no. It's, you know, do you yell? You don't yell stop. You don't yell stuff like, you know, hold on, or, I mean, well, you know, what do you do? So really the only thing to do was to sort of cry as hysterically as possible so that I didn't have to make up any lines. And luckily the tears came out. But that was tough, because obviously we're not looking at a stagecoach. We're looking at, you know, lights behind the camera and probably a truck or two, or, you know, some guy smoking a cigarette. And it was... There was some pretty complicated stuff for a 10-year-old to do on that, because it was definitely a drama, you know, it wasn't a comedy.
Why is it more difficult to cry as an adult actor?
I don't know. In my case, my head's just got more traffic in it now, you know. Things are more complicated, I guess, the older you get. You've got more stuff to think about. Not the least of which is, well, if you don't cry on this take, all those people that are standing behind the camera are going to start rolling their eyes, thinking, "Oh, are we ever going to get to lunch? I mean, we got to get this guy to cry. I mean, come on!" And then, of course, that makes it even more difficult. And so, it's a mess. So, I don't know. Although some years it's easier, and so it's like the almanac. You know, some years it's the rainy years, and some years, you know, the crops don't grow. But this year, I've managed to cry a couple times in some stuff, and I don't know, maybe it's because I lost a dog, or maybe I'm just becoming a softie, but this year was good for the tears.
Not to dwell on Little House on the Prairie, but I want our listeners to hear you as a young actor, and we happen to have a clip from Little House on the Prairie. So this is when you're about 10 or 11, and in this scene, you've already been adopted by, you know, Michael Landon, because your parents were killed, and so... Your older brother has you've taken his razor without his permission and you've broken it. So you've actually stolen another one, and you're trying to pass it off as his in this scene. So here's Jason Bateman at around the age of 10 in Little House on the Prairie.
And I'll sound like a little girl in this, yes?
Well,
just
kind of.
Girl?
Yeah, a little bit.
Hey, Albert, I found your razor.
What?
Yeah, I moved the wood box a little, and there it was.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I knew it'd turn up.
I thought it was gone for sure. I'm sorry for thinking you took it, James. I just didn't... This isn't mine.
What are you talking about? Of course it's your razor.
No, it isn't. I had a bad nick on the blade. I had to be careful of it. Look for yourself.
This is a brand new razor. Where'd you get it, James? James, I asked you a question. Where did you get this razor?
I didn't mean it, Pa. I broke Albert's razor by mistake. I wanted to make it right, but...
James, where did you get this razor? I want an answer now.
From the mercantile.
You stole it. Get up to your room. Get ready for bed. Go on, now.
I love all that high drama music behind
the
scene.
That doesn't make you cry. Nice little music swell. That'll get it done every time. And of course, I had to go upstairs, get ready for bed, which is code for get ready to get a beat down. Mr. Ingalls loved the spanking.
You know, I think a lot of actors and performers, people who are very famous, go through that this confusion about whether people like them for who they are in their public lives, like their character, or who they are in real life. Did you go through that because you started acting so young?
Well, not that specifically, but it was certainly challenging growing up. I was either ostracized in you know, junior high and in elementary school for being a weirdo actor, or there was jealousy, or there was just you're not one of us, or, you know, it's tough enough. But when you're only spending half the year in the classroom and they're seeing you on television and then you show up, you know, midway through the year, it's not comfortable at all. So that wasn't great. And as far as trying to decipher, you know, legitimate and genuine, you know, when people really want to be with you and hang out with you, or whether they just want to hang out with you because you might be pseudo-famous, I don't know. I sort of just banked on my own ability to read people's sincerity. That never really bothered me. Plus, I've never really been, you know, I mean, I'm not Brad Pitt, for God's sakes. You know, I make a living, and I've got, you know, some people know me, but I get down the street just fine. No one bothers me.
You know, one of the problems a lot of child actors face is that they're successful when they're young. They get a series, and then it ends, and no one wants to hire them for roles after that. They become the answer to trivia questions. And they end up, who knows? I mean, because unless they're in the tabloids, we don't know where they end up. Were you worried that would happen to you, that the career that you always wanted since you were 10 would end when you were a teenager, and then you'd move on to something that was less interesting for you?
Yeah, less interesting, less exciting, didn't pay as much money. Yeah, that was a very, very, very... clear and present danger throughout my entire childhood. And again, another reason never to get your kid into it, because you sort of end up buying the confidence and the attitude that you really need to be renting. And it's a very tenuous position. It's a very fickle business, and to think that it's going to last forever is naive at best. So, and that certainly was the case with me. Now, you know, I've acted pretty consistently for 30 years now, and even with that, there were some very painful confusing, you know, dry periods. And you don't know when or if you're ever going to come out of it. And like I said earlier, there's only so much you can do to regenerate that relevance in the industry. And it's frustrating because it always is just one job away. So you kind of also have to be in a constant ready position. You can never let that emotional investment atrophy. You have to be ready literally for the phone to ring, because the following day could be a big audition, and if you've let yourself sort of re-enter normalcy, you're going to then find yourself at that audition and have a bit of a panic because, wait, what am I doing? I'm auditioning for a movie, and I'm not a movie actor. You know, you have to sort of stay in a position of not entitlement, but you just have to be ready. And you could go years and years and years without getting that job. So, as you can imagine, it's a very frustrating position to be in. And fortunately, right now, I'm in a position where my ambition is a match with my level of access right now, and that's rare.
My guest is Jason Bateman. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason Bateman. He stars in the new movie Extract. His recent films include Hancock, Juno, and State of Play. He starred in the TV series Arrested Development. I want to play a scene from Arrested Development, and this is a scene in which your son, played by Michael Cera, has a crush on his ethics teacher, and at a parents' teacher's night, you've met the teacher, you've hit it off, and she has just spent the night with you. So here you are with your son, played by Michael Cera, the next morning.
Hey, George Michael. Wanted to talk to you about something before, but I didn't know if it was real, but now, your ethics teacher...
Yeah, I just made this for her.
Oh.
Yeah, she loves Saddam Hussein.
Well, I'm sure she doesn't love Saddam. I'm sure she is interested in him as a subject, you know.
Right. Yeah. Right, that's what I meant.
Great.
You know, I just wanted to make her something special to show that I care.
About the class?
No, I mean about her.
Oh.
I kind of love her.
You mean you love her, like she loves Saddam, right?
No, I mean like love her.
Oh. Oh.
Oh, hi. Hi, George Michael. I was just looking at this model home. I'm going to go home and think about it.
Dad, what was she doing here? I mean, she wasn't.
Michael knew he had an ethical responsibility to tell his son the truth.
Yes. Your Uncle Job slept with her.
Says my guest Jason Bateman and Michael Cera in a scene from Arrested Development. I think it's fair to say that Arrested Development changed your career, changed the direction of your career.
Yeah.
What was your audition scene?
I don't know, but what I do remember is reading the script and guessing. Obviously, I guessed right about what Mitch Hurwitz needed from that character, which is, you know, someone that would really sort of ground all the eccentric characters that satellite around the character that I played, which was, you know, sort of the bland sort of center of the show, kind of the chicken breast on which you throw all this, you know, these saucy characters. And I remember him following me out of the audition room afterwards, and he said, hey, that was a great job in there. Now you're auditioning for that other pilot that I'm producing tomorrow, right? Because he was producing a few different pilots that year, and I said, yeah. He said, but this one, right? This show, right? You like this show maybe better? Did you like this script better? I said, yeah. He said, yeah. He said, don't come in for that pilot tomorrow, for that other show. I said, okay. And so I guess what he was trying to do was not show that other network and that other group of creators me, because he wanted to save me for Arrested Development. Now, I could have, of course, still gone in on that show the following day. And that show was a show that really had a much, much better chance of getting on the air. It was more of a traditional multi-camera, you know, sitcom in front of a live audience. And this show, Arrested Development, was, as anyone who's ever seen the pilot at least, was very left of center, to say the least, and probably wasn't going to make it on, but it was something that was more consistent with my comedic sensibilities and blah, blah, blah. So I'm glad that at that fork I chose something that was a bit more consistent with my, I don't know, pardon the term, passion, as opposed to, you know, making a buck. And it's paid off quite nicely.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Bateman, and he's starring in the new movie Extract, which opens Labor Day weekend. It's a comedy. I should mention here, your wife is the daughter of Paul Anka. Did you know Paul Anka's records when you met her?
No, I mean, I didn't know his records. I knew that he was the man behind some very, very famous songs, you know, Put Your Head on My Shoulder and you know, Puppy Love and My Way and all that stuff. So I certainly knew what I was dealing with, but did I have his albums? No.
Did he perform at your wedding?
Yeah, he did. He did perform at our wedding. He took the song My Way and he changed the words I think His Way. Basically singing to me about what I was planning to do with and for his daughter and what he hoped that I didn't do with and for his daughter, I think, as I recall. I was in a bit of a blackout. it was a bit nerve-wracking that day.
Was the song funny?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he's, you know, he's an incredible performer. I think he started right about the same time I did, so he's been doing it even longer and has got some very useful advice for me whenever I get the courage to ask him.
Well, Jason Bateman, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Jason Bateman stars in the comedy Extract, which opens Labor Day weekend. His forthcoming films include Up in the Air, which premieres next month at the Toronto Film Festival, and Couples Retreat, which opens in October. His film State of Play comes out on DVD next week.